hello everyone, welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Tim Phillips.
And he's back!
Yeah! Once every couple months, I'm
Once every couple months. Well, you're a busy man these days, and we're glad you can make time for us and for Animated Dogs.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's great to be back, and... Animated Dogs, I always make time for Animated Dogs. So
outstanding. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. You can find us here on CFRU every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new animated movie, The Isle of Dogs. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the news from this past week, including Steven Spielberg. He's got a new movie to promote, so he's making some comments about his own movies and what awards Netflix movies should get. Controversy follows. And then we will mark the 30th anniversary of Beetlejuice, Tim Burton's breakthrough film, and a prime example of what people loved about the director who seems to have gone so horribly wrong in recent years, sadly. But first, China. It's not just for starting trade wars with. Certainly not in Hollywood, who likes doing business with China, and there's no greater proof of that than another movie that's in theaters this week, Pacific Rim Uprising, which I think we can safely say would not exist if it had not been for the Chinese box office, because of, I remember, because at the time I was tracking these things rather closely as part of my nerd writing work, that, yeah, it, I think it made more money in China than it did in the North American box office. So perhaps understandably, because one of the primary settings of that movie is Hong Kong. And
for sure. Much bigger market over there, too.
Much bigger market, And also, they very tightly regulate what American movies end up before their audiences. I think they have a quota of about 10.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, if you want that, if you want
that's
that
prime
slice
real
of them,
estate
that
there.
Is prime real estate. So if you want that slice of Americana, then you only have so many options. But I have not seen Pacific Rim Uprising yet. I have not heard great things, especially since the first one was directed by Guillermo del Toro, and there's is the Cult of del Toro, and the movie series went on without him.
And so much is dependent on the director. I know it's often Pacific Rim's compared to Transformers, but like, it comes down to the director. So Guillermo del Toro could do a Transformers movie and make it good. I think he could add some quality, because he cares about the characters, he cares about the story, the plot line. Where so many of these movies, they're just special effects laden, no transitions from scene to scene. So, I haven't seen the new one either, but from what I read, it seems like it's trying to capitalize on the Chinese market. There's a lot of inclusion of Chinese characters for the sake of trying to appeal to the Chinese market. It seems like there's a real sort of capitalist spin to it as opposed to an artistic spin to it.
In, you know, speaking of capitalist spin, I mean, that is Transformers to a T, which has, because it makes a lot of money in overseas markets, more money than it does in America now or in the North American market, because Canada and the U.S. are counted the same for some reason. But, you know, I'm trying to remember the last Transformers movie not well, but I do remember that in the fourth one, it was a huge, you know, kiss butt to China, because the whole concluding chapter takes place in China. There's a lot of Chinese product placement. They found a role for Lin Bangbang, who was a Chinese actress, but she's like in it as like, I don't know, Stanley Tucci's bodyguard for like, she's in it for, you know, like two scenes. Which I guess, you know, also has to do with the 10 movies a year quota, because if you apparently, you know, offer tribute to China in the terms of casting some of their actors or have Chinese settings, your chances of being screened in China go up. And you know, it's not just a Michael Bay thing. I mean, Marvel famously had a whole Chinese subplot in Iron Man 3 that you didn't see in the North American version, but you did see in the Chinese version. I'm not sure how that worked out, because I think pretty much all of Iron Man 3 is set in America, but it, you know, It happens.
He flew quickly over to China, saved China, came back.
Saved China. he might have. Because the whole, like I said, the subplot was extricated. But it's interesting to consider. There's been a lot of writing on this recently because a lot of people are seeing China as the new cash cow. Mm-hmm. Because DVDs sales aren't there anymore. Streaming can't keep pace with that missing revenue. Box office revenue in North America is going down. But meanwhile, they had a bad year in China last year. Not like necessarily the movies, but economically, which meant there was kind of less money to go around. Mm-hmm. So that's why it wasn't as bountiful, let's say, as it used to be.
And I wonder, I haven't seen the box office receipts from China, but are the top 10 films, those Hollywood movies, those 10, because I know they have a pretty strong artistic culture there, and you'll see Chinese films at like TIFF Bell Lightbox and at TIFF, but are those the ones that are most popular there? Because I know, like, I remember when I was at university, I had a friend from France, and I was like, you want to watch a François Truffaut movie? And he's like, who's François Truffaut?
Yeah.
He's like, let's watch this Eddie Murphy movie instead, you know?
Well, so, yeah, I mean, it'd be like saying to someone, you know, today, do you want to go watch a John Huston movie?
Yeah, exactly.
And they'll be like, who's John Huston?
Yeah.
You know, there's, you know, if you're into films, there are certain names, but if you're just watching film for the pure and you know, just to kill time or because you want to watch a movie, it's a bit trickier. I am glad you asked that question, though, because in 2017, four out of the top five movies were Chinese.
Oh, they were, okay.
Which is another reason Hollywood people are worried, because if all the money's going to Chinese films, heaven forbid. But yeah, the one Hollywood movie that cracked the top five was Fate of the Furious.
Okay.
Which,
exporting just pure quality.
Diesel. Yeah. And yeah, you can understand why. I mean, it's a big action franchise, and also it's very ethically diverse. I mean, I don't think there are any Asian actors on the Fast team, but it is still more representative than most of your average Hollywood blockbusters. But the big one, of course, was Wolf Warrior 2, which made $854 million.
Wow.
Yeah. Which would make it, in North American box office, would make it like two or three the number one domestic hit of all time.
Wow. Yeah.
But, you know, here's another example. Like, say to someone, you know, what was one of the most profitable movies last year? Wolf Warrior 2. And people would be like, what's Wolf Warrior 2?
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's basically the Chinese Rambo.
Yeah, so you can see, because the film game, it's such a business, right, when you're at that level. So, if I was a Hollywood producer and I wanted to score big in China, I definitely would take advantage of that. You know, it's a pretty cynical way to do things, but I guess.
Well, there's actually an actress named Jing Tian who's in Pacific Rim Uprising, but she's also kind of like the go-to Chinese actress for all these movies. She was in, at least for this one production company, the one that's behind Pacific Rim, because she was also in Kong Skull Island.
Yeah, say that five times really fast.
Yeah. And she was also in The Great Wall, which, you know, is problematic for a number of reasons, but not the least of which that it sucked, but that, but she's sort of like popped up, and you know, I guess she's like the go-to person for them. It's like, we need a Chinese person to, I guess, make this more Chinese, or something.
Yeah.
And then I was reading like a comment section online, and somebody's like, she isn't even one of the good Chinese actors. It's like
these comment sections, though. I was reading that too. It's like, wow, yeah, it's just, oh, she's not even beautiful. And then I look at a picture. Yeah, I think she is beautiful. I don't know. When you get on these forums, the nastiness comes out, right?
Well, the nastiness comes out. I do wonder, it's, you know, she has all this time for these American movies. Perhaps she isn't one of their brightest stars. But in Hollywood, they don't care because, you know, she has the right, you know, birth certificate.
Right, yeah.
So it's,
it's interesting, too, from that perspective, because a big topic right now is cultural appropriation.
Mm-hmm.
So if you looked at it from maybe our perspective, even in Canada, trying to be, you know, politically correct and everything, then we would say, wow, this is total cultural appropriation, yet it plays well in China, even though these characters are, from what I've read, I haven't seen the movie, like in Pacific Rim, like they've got a almost like a tacked on secondary characters just to, you know, appease the Chinese market, which seems to me, which would be just cultural appropriation in a way, you know?
Yeah.
Especially if the directors are all American, all white Americans.
Right. It's stuff. It's pure cultural appropriation because it's like we are taking your culture and selling it back to you because you are only about seeing a Chinese face in a movie, even though everyone else is white or black or whatever.
Yeah, like if you're going to do that, go big, like make the lead characters Chinese or make the story more about that. But I guess they want to have it both ways, like you were saying, like that Iron Man example.
Yeah.
So they want it to be big in North America and even probably bigger in China. So
yeah,
it's like they're playing both sides. They're doing these alternate versions. So to do that, you can't really be true to either side, really. It's sort of, okay, here's some characters. It's kind of like some of the Marvel movies, too, right? They're trying to just tack on all these characters to really get the nerds happy. Okay, all these Marvel characters are in this one movie, but...
It's funny you should say that because I recently bought the Godzilla 1985. It's been hard to find on DVD because I think it was a rights issue, but I guess someone was able to get the rights to the Japanese version and release the Japanese version. I'm only familiar with the Americanized version, which has like Raymond Burr, scenes with Raymond Burr intercut. And I wonder if the Iron Man 3 Chinese cut is like that, where all of a sudden you go to China where there's other stuff happening, sort of related. But I don't think anyone wants that because, anyway.
Yeah, it'd be an interesting thing to watch, though. It'd be if you're able to watch that somewhere. I guess.
I'm sure you can pirate it from somewhere. Not that we're advocating pirating, but there you go.
But if you're going to pirate the Chinese Iron Man.
Pirate Chinese Iron Man should be a t-shirt. speaking of adding things, we got Steven Spielberg back in theaters. It seemed like he was just in theaters with The Post. Well, it kind of was like that, but he's got Ready Player One coming out next week, or this week, I should say. We're reviewing it next week. There you go. So it's coming out, but he's doing interviews and stuff, and everyone's looking for like cool things to get Spielberg to say. We'll deal with the lesser one first, which was that he's pledged to never again digitally alter his movies because he famously did that for I think it was the 20th anniversary release of E.T. where he did some digital face additions to E.T.
And he changed guns to walkie-talkies.
And he said, like, never again, learn my lesson. Everyone's like, phew, Jaws is safe. there's no going to be any like new scenes of a CGI gray white shark.
Not
going to
incorporate Sharknado into it in any way. have to update this.
It's funny. He should talk about this though, because I'm not sure who else would like bother to do this except him. And I think this was like peer pressure from the studio. He was saying like we got to do something to make it, you know, give people a reason to come back in the theaters, as if seeing E.T. on the big screen wasn't reason enough. It's also from the George Lucas school, who had never re-released Star Wars without tinkering again with something,
right? Always tinkering, and then you watch it, and then from one tinker to the next you're like, okay, what did he do exactly? Okay, I paid my money to watch. He's got my money now, which is what it's all about, right? Just new ways to get the movies into theaters.
Right. The more controversial of Spielberg's comments, though, was about Netflix movies. And, of course, the changing real estate of the movie business. Someone asked him about Netflix and, like, streaming movies winning Oscars. And he said, I don't believe that films that are given token qualifications at a couple of theaters for less than a week should qualify for Academy Award nominations. And he added, once you commit to the television format, you're a TV movie. which seems odd given his big break was a TV movie.
Duel,
yeah,
right?
Which did get a theatrical release overseas.
Yeah. I don't know.
I was praised for the cinematics and having a cinema quality.
Great. Yeah.
It's a great movie, yeah.
It's a great movie.
Yeah.
I might be out of touch, but I kind of agree with what he's saying. Like, no, I do. Like, people are watching Netflix like they used to watch TV, basically, you know, in a
true.
Lot of respects. So whether it's a long format movie or it's a series, it strikes me as it's like the new TV. So when TV eventually goes away, which it may go away 20 years from now, the Emmy Awards will have to be given awards for something. And I think it would be more Netflix, including like the movies. But what gets a bad rap are TV movies have bad connotations, right?
Right.
When you call something a TV movie, it's like, okay, it's like movie of the week or something.
Yeah,
it's
you think of like Danielle Steele and all these Lifetime Women in Peril movies.
Yeah, Hallmark movies or whatever.
Yeah, the Hallmark movies, the Christmas ones, like Once Upon a Christmas or Christmas in Danger or what. Like, yeah.
So I could see if I was a filmmaker, I was confident in my skills, and I wouldn't want to be categorized as like a TV movie of the week. But maybe at some point, those connotations will go away. Because I agree with them, and this whole like token thing, this like put it in the theaters for a week. That's just to get around the stipulations. I think that's just finding a loophole, and like who's really going for that week, and you know, like who's getting a chance to see it in a theater, really.
Well, everybody loves the loopholes. I mean, The Post was qualified for an Oscar because of the loophole. It was released like in theaters like a week before the end of the year, so it could qualify. So you know, you can't really complain about the loopholes that work for you and the loopholes that don't work
hypocrisy
for you.
He might be just have sour grapes. Was this after the Oscars, this interview?
Yeah. Maybe it is, but it could be. I think there's validity to the point that Netflix is playing fast and loose with the rules, but I think that's also specific to Netflix, because you have Amazon Prime, which will, you know, Manchester by the Sea, which was their movie, was released in like 1,200 theaters, and even Wonder Wheel, in the midst of second guessing Woody Allen, was still released in 500 theaters, so. I wonder if
Amazon's different. Yeah,
Amazon
wasn't The Big Sick an Amazon movie too, I believe.
I think you're right. Yes.
Yeah, and that was played in a ton of theaters. Yeah.
In terms of indie movies, that was huge.
Yeah.
You're right, and so I'm just curious. Isn't Amazon the middle ground? Because I think Netflix sucks all the attention because it's Netflix. It's the brand name.
Right.
And if Netflix moved to a more Amazonian model.
Yeah.
if you know, we might, because Spielberg isn't certainly the first person who's beat up on Netflix for this, organizers of Con have. And when you're talking about movies on Netflix, like, you know, you're talking about Mudbound or The Final Years, and Spielberg specifically mentioned, you know, competition at Sundance. Well, that's where Netflix is picking up these movies, is festivals like Sundance and SXSW, and, you know, they're seeing the films that are up for distribution, and like, you know, Fox Searchlight or, you know, Focus Features, you know, they're bidding on them too. And because Netflix is the cool new thing, people are kind of more willing to go with Netflix, with it being the brand name, sort of in full realization that the platform is going to be the thing you're going to see that movie on, not necessarily the 1 week in theaters, as you're saying.
Yeah. And actually, now that I think of it, right, like a lot of people who vote on the Oscars, they watch on DVD because they get advanced copies on DVD.
Very true, very true.
So they're not watching it at a theater.
Yeah.
I think in a perfect world, you'd watch the movies in a theater to really...
Yeah, for sure.
...to really judge them. Because I know this year for, like, the Best Picture Oscars, like, I saw, like, 5 out of 6 in a theater, and the one I didn't was Dunkirk. And I'm like... I'm like, I didn't really like it that much. And I'm thinking maybe it's because I wasn't in a theater watching it. You know what I'm saying?
It wasn't in the full Dolby IMAX experience.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I can understand what you're saying. Yeah, if they go more to an Amazonian use that word, model, if that's the right word for it. But if Netflix
could, I like it. We'll keep it in. Yeah.
if Netflix would go to that, at least have their movies show in more theaters. Because like a movie like Mudbound, I know a lot of people ended up watching on Netflix, especially after the Oscar nominations. But have that in some theaters, you know. I'm sure you'd get quite a few viewers. And
it's not like Netflix is averse to spending money.
Yes.
You know, if you look at how many Netflix originals there are, they're spending money like water. So, you know, put some of that money into like giving it something like Mudbound a real distribution, and maybe it would have like a real chance at winning Oscars. Because the fact that Mudbound was nominated and got several nominations is good, but I don't think it was ever really in the conversation, except for the fact that Rachel Morrison was the first woman to be nominated for cinematography.
Right, yeah, and then Mary J. Blige was nominated for two Oscars, right, for Song and Supporting Actress, and then also the Netflix angle as well. It got some press from that. But it'd be great to see those at a theater, you know. So theaters, in many cases, are a dying breed as well, and it'd be nice to...
I mean, that's true, too, there are still a lot of theaters around, but a lot of that real estate is taken up for, you know, three screens for Black Panther and two screens for Wrinkle in Time, and there's not a lot of room left for these smaller movies just because of the economy of the situation, going back to point one.
Yeah, for like movies like Mudbound, for sure. Yeah. Oh, here we're getting a little music.
I wanted to cue the music. because actually, it is the 29th. What is this today? The 28th? So, 30 years ago tomorrow. We got Beetlejuice.
Oh no!
It's funny though. This almost went right by me. Until I found like this article on the random website that's like, oh yeah, it's like almost 30 years ago Beetlejuice came out.
Wow, I'm getting old.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I love having the music on in the background. Yeah. But it's, it makes you feel old because, you know, there was something.
If you were alive when it was.
Oh, yeah. No, I was, 9 or 10. But it's funny because I remember until I sort of started revisiting things from when I was a kid, you know, I remembered Beetlejuice predominantly from the cartoon came on afterwards. And the cartoon, of course, is a very sanitized version of the movie. So when you go back and see the movie, it's one of these relics of the 80s where you remember what you were able to get away with a PG rating, a straight PG rating.
It's very dark. Yeah, like comedies back then, like Gremlins, for instance, when they turn into gremlins in the movie theater. And And you think the scenes in Beetlejuice, he's such a slimy character. And
he's a complete sleaze. It's so weird because you have the two main characters, and the Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis character are the main characters, and Beetlejuice is a side character at best. Right. He's kind of a MacGuffin in a sense. Yeah. Who are like kind of very wholesome and you know, very sweet and kind natured, and they're just trying to get their house. They just want to live in their house and be nice, and then they turn to this complete and utter just sleaze of a character, and he's so bad you can't even use his name. He's been relegated to the fringes of even the afterlife. Yeah. Which is so bizarre. And speaking of the afterlife, it's this movie's vision of the afterlife, where it's just like this bureaucratic,
nullifying, all the paperwork.
Where you like you die and you're given a manual on what it's like to be dead.
That's hilarious. Yeah,
you go and see your advisor, and you have to take a number, and of course the numbers are all in the three digits. And so you're waiting for decades to, for her to basically tell you to read the manual and, haunt the living. It's this bizarre vision.
Yeah, because they get that manual, what is it, How to Survive in the Afterlife or something it's called?
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to rewatch it, but it's like something to that effect.
Yeah.
And it's...
How to Navigate the Afterlife or something, yeah.
And it's just kind of given to them, and they kind of find it, and of course, it's a typical bureaucracy, and they're like, well, what do we do about this? It's in the manual!
Yeah. And it is, it's a really dark movie. And I know my brother has younger children. And he showed it to them recently, I remember. Mm-hmm. He was mentioning, and I was just saying, wow, are they scared? Yeah, they're a little bit scared. Because that's how movies were in the 80s, right? Yeah. Like Gremlins, Poltergeist. And another one that came to mind actually was like Pee-wee's Big Adventure. How that's like a kid's movie, but it's got some really creepy stuff in there as well. And it was directed by Tim Burton.
It's got some strong innuendo, too.
Yeah.
And well, the thing about Pee-wee is that it was kind of always subversive like that. Mm-hmm. And if the Pee-wee TV show, too, mm-hmm. was, I'm not sure how much of it was like for kids and how much of it was just like dressed in kids' clothes. Yeah. And it was just like this, you know, there was just this subversive quality to it. It was as much mocking the idea of kid shows as it was being a
And then
kid
it
show.
Won like an armload of Emmys for the kids' programming right. as well. It's crazy. But yeah, first thing I thought of when I was thinking Beetlejuice, how it was dark and when I was a kid, I was like Pee-wee's Big Adventure because I saw that quite a bit when I was a kid as well. And how, and then how that was really dark and creepy, and they're stealing his bike. And when you're a kid, that's your biggest nightmare almost.
Yes.
Somebody's going to steal my bike, right?
Yeah.
And then I was thinking, Tim Burton directed that one as well.
The thing I love about Pee-wee's Big Adventure is like the Pee-wee movie at the end, the movie in a movie where it's James Brolin as P.W. Herman. Yeah. That makes me laugh. But going back to Burton, it's weird how you see how, you know, off those movies were in terms of just like it's offbeat vision. Mm-hmm. And now you have Tim Burton who's cranking out just like some of the basest Hollywood hogwash. Like, mm-hmm. it seems like he peaked with Sleepy Hollow, which is a movie I adore. Mm-hmm. But then you go into Planet of the Apes, which I'm more forgiving of than many people. Mm-hmm. But then you go into Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and then you go into like Sweeney Todd, but you get into, you know, Alice in Wonderland,
all with Johnny Depp, with the heavily makeup Johnny Depp,
right? And it's like this nonstop, like every Tim Burton claptrap. It's like he's parroting himself at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then he's tried to adjust since, where he did Big Eyes, which has its moments.
Big Fish.
Big Fish, yeah.
Oh, I really like Big Fish.
I really like Big Fish, too.
Oh, yeah, Big Eyes, I remember.
Big Eyes, but there was Big Eyes in between.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Miss Peregrine's Home, which I'm not a fan of the book. I like the concept of the book, but I wasn't a fan of the book. Mm-hmm. And and he did Dark Shadows, too, which, mm-hmm. blah. Now he's working on Dumbo, and it's like... like where it happened to Tim Burton. It's
just do something quirky like you used to, right?
Like
I really like Edward Scissorhands and Beetlejuice. It's a weird movie. I like it. Yeah.
But he had a quality of like what Quentin Tarantino does, where Quentin Tarantino takes all the movies he's ever seen, but recycles them through his Quentin and Tarantino-ness. And Tim Burton did the same thing. Like with Beetlejuice, you have a lot of Harryhauser, you have Hammer. Horror mm-hmm. movies, you have, you know, like hilarious House of Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. And then he kind of rectified that through his own weirdness and projected that back in him as Beetlejuice, or even something like Edward Scissorhands or Ed Wood or even mm-hmm. Batman Returns especially. Mm-hmm. But now it's like all he understands is his... I think what people see as his style, and now he's trying to copy himself.
Yeah, I think that's true for a lot of artists, because I think of, like, a lot of rock bands I like. The Rolling Stones, right?
Yeah.
Like, to me, they created some of the best rock and roll music from late 60s to, like, mid-70s, or maybe late 70s. Mm-hmm. And now they've just been recycling that since.
Right.
And I saw them live, and it was great. So, like, if Tim Burton, you get that Tim Burton experience, but it's maybe now it's more predictable because he's lost that artistic fire in a way, you
right.
know?
Right, name a Rolling Stones song that was produced in the last 20 years.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And of course, the Rolling Stones brand now is almost like, yeah, we're still here, still doing.
And Tim Burton's
not dead yet.
And Tim Burton's got that brand, because I remember when I went to Paris, I went there for a vacation, and I wanted to go. We went to the Cinémathèque Française there, and it's like, wow. And we just went to see the permanent exhibit, but they had the Tim Burton exhibit up, and they were lined up around the block. And we thought it was to get into the main, and we were like, oh, there's a lot of classic French people who are here to see the dawn of cinema. But no, it was all for Tim Burton, and it's like he's still... But
they were not Hugo fans.
No, yeah. That's who we saw, yeah. It was cool. In there, too, if you ever go, I don't know, have you been there before? They have the mother's head from Psycho as well in there.
Nice.
Yeah, it's really cool. But anyway, he's still got that cult, and I imagine, like, I know he did that, there was that exhibit at TIFF, too, that's probably, like, 6-7 years ago.
Yeah.
But I'm sure if he did another one, it would still be very popular. So he still has this cult about him, but
sure.
Are people really referencing his new movies, or are they the movies from the 90s, or before that, right?
You might be onto something there.
Yeah.
But we'll have to call that there in terms of our news discussion for the week. We're going to move on to a review of Isle of Dogs. But first, a little song called In Motion, which I thought was apropos for stop motion. And it's from a band called Their Dogs Were Astronauts. No astronauts in Isle of Dogs, but, you know, maybe next time, Wes Anderson. Anyway, you are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Before we attack each other and tear ourselves to shreds like a pack of maniacs, let's just open the sack first and see what's actually in it. It might not even be worth the trouble.
What do you think?
I'm not sure.
Maybe.
Hi.
A rancid apple core, 2 worm-eaten banana peels, a moldy rice cake, a dried-up pickle, tin of sardine bones, a pile of broken eggshells, an old smushed-up rotten gizzard with maggots all over it.
Okay, it's worth it. Get out of here and don't come back.
Sheesh, Igor, I think he chewed your ear off.
That's what happens when you're on Trash Island. That was a clip from Isle of Dogs. It's a new film from Wes Anderson, and it features the voice talents of Edward Norton, Bryan Cranston, Koyu Rankin, Bill Murray, Jeff Goldblum, Kenichi Nomura, Greta Gerwig, Frances McDormand, and Scarlett Johansson.
And Yoko Ono in a brief
Yoko Ono
cameo.
In there very briefly. 40 years later, or 50 years later, still being ranked over the Coles for ending the Beatles. It's feel sorry for her. it's a stop-motion animated movie, which is not unfamiliar to Wes Anderson. He did a full stop-motion animation movie with The Fantastic Mr. Fox. Mm-hmm. And there were stop-motion components to The Life Aquatic as well. All the undersea things were stop-motion in that movie. It's interesting because my reaction to this is very bilateral. Because I saw it, and I enjoyed it very much, and then I decided to read some other reviews.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
And then going back to our first topic with cultural appropriation.
Correct, yeah.
And some of the concerns that movie critics who are not male and white have brought up in terms of...
Yeah, it's very interesting, because I really enjoyed the movie watching it, like you.
Yeah.
And it's only screening right now in Toronto, but in one theater, and it was pretty packed there when I saw it, and a lot of people behind me, they were laughing, and then afterwards I saw they were younger white people. I saw a lot of people lining up, a lot of Asian people lining up to watch the movie, so I'd be interested to know what the people who were at the same screening as me thought about it. But then I read articles afterwards, and it tended to be a lot of Asian Americans writing reviews talking about the cultural appropriation, mm-hmm. which is a big topic right now. And actually, I'm actually putting on a play for the Fringe show in Toronto, and I did have some Asian elements to it. And I've actually decided because they weren't really integral to the plot.
Mm-hmm.
And I did need to pare down the play too. It's going to run over the hour, so
right.
I took that out because it's just nowadays, you know, you do have to be sensitive, and it's a good thing in a way, right? It's mm-hmm. a good thing to be more sensitive to people's beliefs and cultures, and the fact that a lot of this criticism is coming from Asian American sources,
right,
as opposed to someone who's trying to talk on behalf of a different culture,
right?
You put more credence in that. So,
well, I think what has struck people is that the fact that it's set in Japan, but there's nothing really about it that requires the point of view of the Japanese culture.
No, actually, there's one thing I thought about. Yeah, that's a good argument, but I'm not sure if you really thought about this, but it could be like referring back to the Japanese internment camps,
right?
And the fact that these dogs are exiled to this island, having it in Japan could reference back to those dark days in Canada and the United States.
That
right?
had occurred to me.
Yeah,
but Wes Anderson has never been a message filmmaker.
Right, yeah.
Except that his message is, weird people are cool. You should like
fun.
Weird people.
Eccentricity.
Everyone should listen to the weird people.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, you know, when it comes to, like, the bigger, broader real world stuff, mm-hmm. That, you know, he doesn't really deal with that at all. And, you know, when you look at Rushmore and Max Fleischer's, you know, plays about Vietnam, they're not actually based on any kind of Vietnam experience. They're based on Vietnam movies he's
right.
seen.
Yeah.
So, you know, even when he tries to touch on things, it's through this lens of like the pop culture mm-hmm. and how other people have described these bigger world things to him, you know, through cinema and theater and through books and comics and all that.
Right. It makes you wonder though. I enjoyed the film.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people, like, you can tell when you're in a theater, most people there were enjoying it, I think. But it'd be interesting to think about that debate, like, if it was the other side, and this is, like, the devil's advocate argument. What if somebody in Japan who's a filmmaker and actually has never been to the United States but has seen Hollywood movies or watched The Grapes of Wrath or something and decided they're going to do a Dust Bowl or something about poverty in the United States.
Right.
Which actually would be a message movie, so that's probably not the best example. But they've just seen a lot of American stuff and they decide to do that.
Right.
Is that then cultural appropriation? You know, like...
Yeah.
You know, like, that's the thing. I think we have to be sensitive in these times, but it is tough. It's a tough balancing act because Wes Anderson, like you said, he's so used to he's probably inundated his mind with all these references to movies he's seen.
Right.
A lot of Japanese movies, you know, like we referenced before, like Godzilla and and he's seen all these movies in his childhood and he sees Japanese culture probably in the United States in you know, neighborhoods and what restaurants he goes to and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So he's incorporating that. But at what point is it like a stereotype?
Right.
And what point is it just like a celebration, I guess?
I'm sure it would have... I think one of the more problematic things is... Well, a couple. And this sort of... Because even when you read those reviews by those people who have been critical of the movie, they're still like, we like the movie too. It was funny and we had a good time.
Yeah.
Just, you know, it's sort of after the fact analysis.
Yeah.
But I think They have all the dog characters played by American actors.
Yeah, exactly.
With speaking in American English.
Right, yeah.
All the Japanese characters are Japanese actors speaking Japanese. And sometimes, you know, there's a character they're translating or there's subtitles, but not always.
Yeah.
So there's automatically sets up this wall of the other just by the way it's presented, which I thought was interesting. But, yeah. You know, there are other ways to interpret things.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is there the one character who has like a problem with what's going on is a white American teenage girl,
right?
Which
yeah.
is sort of sets, and she has this like big afro yeah. with blonde hair,
yeah.
and but you know, so she kind of falls into the manic pixie dream girl kind of mold as well.
Yeah,
voiced by Greta Gerwig, who's the only character we see on the Japanese mainland who speaks English. So you know, all this together, I think the movie could have overcome any one thing, but you know, when it's When you get into like the white savior complex, all the dogs are basically yeah. American. It's
yeah.
and it gets into a sticky wicket that it's once you kind of see it, it's yeah. hard to dig your mind out of it.
Yeah, because it didn't unless he was making and it's debatable whether he's making any sort of political statement about
yes.
like internment camps or anything from the past.
Concentration camps yeah. with yeah. gassing
yeah.
people.
Yeah, if he, yeah. unless he's doing that, which it doesn't seem to be in his past, then it is yeah. sort of like. Sort of like this cultural tourism in a way, and it's
yeah.
just sort of okay. I like these little I'm adding these flourishes without really digging deep into characters. And I know there were Japanese voice talent in it, like, but you know, like Yoko Ono was in it for like 2 minutes or something, you know. And I know the lead child is Japanese, but yeah, yeah the Hollywood. I'm starting to have a problem with that for a few different reasons. Mm-hmm. One is all these like animated movies now, it's like they're all sold on these on this voice talent.
Right.
That's like the Hollywood stars. So I want to go and I really love Jeff Goldblum's voice. I thought he was awesome. And Edward Norton.
Yeah. They
have such distinctive voices.
Yeah.
But it's like there's so much voice talent out there that doesn't get an opportunity anymore.
Right.
Ever since, I don't know when, maybe like Toy Story, when Tom Hanks and Tim Allen are...
Yeah.
And now all these animated movies that they don't need to have... They do. They get to get the big box office. They're having like George Clooney and stuff, but...
Well, in the case of Isle of Dogs, it's, you know, yeah. it's the Wes Anderson repertoire players like
yeah.
Bill Murray and Jeff Goldblum and Ed Norton.
Exactly. But it'd be good to give some other people
right.
an opportunity. Like, I was thinking like...
Jim Cunning needs to work. Is what, you yeah. know, Frank... what's his name? Frank Welker. Yeah.
yeah. And, you know, if you were to set it in Japan, then maybe... You go to Japan. I don't know if he did or not. Or and you include people in your team, and then also like have the actors. Why not have Japanese actors?
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to George Clooney. You know, I know he's your favorite and all this stuff. But
who doesn't love George Clooney?
Yeah, it's just,
and Bryan Cranston plays the main dog in it,
yeah.
Chief. And I think this is his first Anderson movie.
Yeah. And they all do a good job, and
yeah.
and part of it is you recognize the voice, right?
Sure.
So it's like, oh, that's Bryan Cranston, okay.
Yeah.
But
I'm not sure Bryan Cranston has that distinctive a voice. I mean, he
yeah.
sounded familiar, but I didn't leap out of my seat and go, oh, Bryan Cranston.
Yeah, and are you going to go because Bryan Cranston's the voice
right.
of the
main
Duke
dog.
Or whatever?
Yeah.
but...
Yeah, it's, but I understand that part because, you know, Wes Anderson works with a lot of the same people and, you know, he's one of those quirky directors like that where he's like, I
yeah.
have my gang, like Tilda Swinton and
yeah.
F. Murray Abraham and all those guys. And yeah, it's...
I will say...
it is funny to hear, you know, those actors come out of the mouths of stop-motion dogs and that's
yeah.
part of the joy of it, yeah.
And I do like Wes Anderson's animated stuff because
mm-hmm.
I find sometimes in his live action stuff where these characters are getting contemplative and oh woe is me, when you see real people you're like I'm like almost get over it, you know, like why are you but when it's animated it's cute and it's fun and
yeah
and that it was cute and fun, but like you said, once you start to look at, you know, some of the flourishes he put on there, were they actually necessary? And he could have put Dog Island anywhere, I suppose.
Yeah.
But then do you get in a debate if he puts it anywhere?
Yeah.
Does he have to put it in, like, the Gulf of Mexico or something because he's from Houston, Texas? Does he have to,
right.
You know?
Well, I mean, it also might have to do it. You could believably collect all the dogs. Maybe not so believably, but it's. Yeah. But you could believably, Japan being a small, relatively compact place, mm-hmm. versus something like the United States, where, you know, can you imagine? Can't even imagine them rounding up all their guns, let alone all their dogs. but you know, there's nothing to say it couldn't have been like off Britain or you know, someplace like that, another island-based country.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, someplace like Hawaii, where, you know, it's out in the middle of the ocean. Although that might have opened up another can of worms with you know, southern South Pacific peoples.
Mm-hmm.
yeah. But, you know, I do want to talk about the good parts of this because it's very enjoyable. I liked the. You know, of course, it's a Wes Anderson movie, so there's all this incredible attention to detail.
Mm-hmm.
The island is this fascinating place where where it's like every natural disaster has sort of befallen it. And but, you know, the impression is that for years people have been building there and operating out of there in various factories and towns, and they eventually gave up and just made it a trash island. So it's this incredibly geographically diverse Wes Anderson setting, which is funny. And I like a lot of the little characters who pop up. Like, there's the dog who does the narrating, who's voiced by F. Murray Abraham, and his sidekick, the Oracle.
The Oracle's hilarious.
That's a vision.
That was the funniest character I found in the whole thing. The Oracle, who could tell the future
by watching the television.
Because it's the one dog that understands TV.
That's right. I mean, that part of it was great, and I love the scenes of Atari, which is the Japanese boy. I love the, like, wandering around the island, and the dogs don't understand him, and he doesn't understand the dogs, but they're off on this adventure together. And I think if that had been more of the movie without sort of the political stuff, I think that would have been interesting.
It probably would have been. I think a big appeal for people is, like, dog owners. I'm not a dog owner, but I think if you're a dog owner,
you would
really love this movie, or if you've owned dogs in the past, because just the bonding of the child with the dog and then a new dog, and just, you know, it's just it's great, and it's all the cute things that dogs do. They're doing that, and
there's a lot of these close-ups of the dogs, mm-hmm. and whether it's just like them blinking or there's like a breeze and you can sort of see the fur fly. It is incredible. Even though the dogs aren't real, it does tap into those feelings. Because I have had dogs in the past.
Yeah.
And it does tap into those feelings that this was your best friend.
Yeah.
And to, you know, it's a tribute to that relationship. And
Wes is really good at, like, the childlike stuff. So
yeah,
I kind of agree with what you're saying. He didn't necessarily have to have this political. Well, I guess he did because they're exiling him to this island, but he didn't have to make it because there's all these political speeches in it and stuff that seems a little disjointed now in retrospect. Now that
almost feels it's tapping into things like fear and like government bred fear for political purposes and but it starts off with like this fairy tale about, you know, this cat empire that tried to wipe out the dogs, and then the dogs managed to be saved by one lone boy samurai,
mm-hmm.
and then it goes from there into this political thing with Mayor Kobayashi and the dog flu, and we have to get rid of all the dogs and we're going to exile them, and then that exile's not enough for Mayor Kobayashi, who's always seen with a cat.
Yeah.
And so I guess it's implied that he is like the latest descendant from Cat Empire or what have you. But that, you know, it's not enough to exile the dogs. You have to wipe them out in a glorious kind of mechanized Holocaust-style death.
Yeah, it's cat people versus dog people, right? Yeah.
And it adds a tone of seriousness to it, and it's very easy to see the modern reflection of that with what's happening in the United States with the president there talking about building walls
and
certain people who have to be thrown out and all these existential dangers. Except, again, Wes Anderson is not a message movie maker, and we're not 100% sure he's trying to send a message here. Like, is this a fairy tale? Is this an allegory? Or is it just about a boy and searching for his dog, his best friend, who, this boy who has lost his family, lost everything, and he's given this dog who is like, this dog will be your protector. And that goes both ways for the boy and for the dog. And there's actually a line in there that the Scarlett Johansson dog. Who says, you know, the chief, is, the Bryan Cranston dog is the one who kind of is iffy about Atari. And he has a conversation with Scarlett Johansson and she's like, well, you know, he's a 12-year-old boy. 12-year-old boys love dogs. And
there's Scarlett Johansson again as like the alluring. That's everything she's in. They could have had more female representation of dogs, I suppose. They had her, and she's the sex symbol, basically, yet again.
She's the sexy dog.
Yeah.
Although there's a misunderstanding about that. Like, is she Felix's mate or is she not Felix's mate? It's like, you know, gossip and rumors and all that. And then, the only other female dog is the Oracle. But there's also another female dog who's a mother figure, so it's...
The Oracle, it's really funny.
The Oracle is great. I would love to... Like, if there was, like, a short with I can't remember the dog's name that is the boss dog who has, like, the thing of brandy around his neck. But that him and the Oracle, if there was, like, a little short with them, like, a little adventure with them, I would love that.
That would be good. That'd be a good DVD extra. Because, when they popped up on screen, it was hilarious. People were laughing. And then and then the Oracle, so funny. It's like, tells the future because they understand TV. And then there's a little clip with the Oracle right at the end where I swear she's watching Jeopardy. You see, it's just for a second. It's like,
I missed that.
Like,
but...
Yeah, it's right at the end when everything's been resolved, and all of a sudden you see she's watching Jeopardy for one second.
I like the group of dogs, and we kind of, it feels like we kind of lose that thread when they get separated with the group with like Edward Norton and well, he's not the leader. It's very clear that they are a democratic group of
There's
of
a power
dogs.
Struggle.
There's a power struggle.
The Stray, which is George Clooney, right?
That's Bryan Cranston, Chief.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. And Edward Norton always wants to be the leader as well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Edward Norton is the idea man or the idea dog, and he keeps making
things
suggestions.
To a vote.
And Chief's like, you're not the leader. And everyone's like, fine, let's have a vote. And they all vote Edward Norton's way. And, you know, stuff like that I dug a lot.
Yeah.
But they're also typical Wes Anderson things, you know, this idea that, you know, we want to be egalitarian, but there is always one person who's kind of driving the ideas and the story.
Yeah, that's a funny feature of a lot of his films, right?
Yeah.
Like, this momentum is caused by one person, even though they're making it seem like it's a collective. It's one person or one dog that's leading the charge. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought Jeff Goldblum was really funny with the rumors.
Where are you getting these
rumors?
Yeah, he was great. Again, the little things like that. He's like, why are you hearing these rumors?
Yeah.
I mean, Wes Anderson's great with character, and I don't know. It's like there were like six of them that worked on the story, including Roman Coppola and Jason Schwartzman. And so I'm wondering how much of Anderson is kind of there in the underlying story and how much this is kind of like them like sitting around shooting the breeze and like, okay, so there's this Isle of Dogs. How did they get there?
Yeah. Coming up with all these funny scenarios, right?
And then it ends up in the blender, the proverbial, you know, screenwriting blender. I think he has the lone screenwriting credit but it just strikes me as, I don't know, maybe there were too many cooks in the kitchen right off the bat, and Wes Anderson's like, I have an idea about dogs on an island, and it's Japanese. Who else? Let's throw some stuff at the wall. And
but the impression with him is he likes to have all that stuff in the blender, right? Because it's always like this chaotic environment that's happening, and it's like, okay, and there's all these little references everywhere. So it seems like he would want as many ideas as possible to try to try to incorporate into that story.
Right? And it works. And it works in like Grand Budapest, which is a lot like that, where you're kind of swinging from one branch to the next. But
yeah.
I think the thing about that movie, it was kind of set up as a flashback. That you know, it's this story being told to someone, so you're seeing it all in a flashback. So you can just sort of jump to point to point to point to point.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this, you know, it's set up in the first as like a fairy tale, and then it moves on to this political thing, and it kind of, and then you go on this adventure on Trash Island, where it, you know, has a very kind of Muppets or Goonies feel, and then you come right back around again to the political stuff, and it's. I still like the movie a lot, but it's given me a lot more to think about than I would have thought going in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's so much to think about these days, right?
Too much to think about sometimes.
it's good, though. It's good to... Because, Hollywood's had a way of doing things for so long that it's... Actually, good to shake it up a little bit.
Yeah.
And people can start to look at things differently. Maybe Wes Anderson will after this, or maybe he won't. Maybe he's at that stage in his career where he's like, "I'm just going to do whatever I do. I'm going to be Wes Anderson." Right.
So. Right. And it's. I think it's worth checking out for everybody listening when it. You know.
Yeah, it's definitely entertaining, and it's really funny and cute. And if you like dogs, you'll like it a lot for sure.
Mm-hmm. We'll stamp Woof. That. Stamp that on the poster.
if you like dogs, you have to like this. Yeah.
And that is it for our show this week. I'm afraid we'll have to cut it off there. You can listen to us again on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. All our episodes are archived there for your easy listening pleasure. You can find us on social media at End Credits Radio Show on Facebook and End Credits Radio on Twitter. Tim, since you featured so prominently your work at the Fringe Festival, why don't you tell us what you're up to and where people can find out more?
Yeah, I'm directing a play at the Toronto Fringe Festival this year. It's called The Joy of Sax. It's a quirky comedy. It's 1 hour long. You can find us on social media, Flash in the Deadpan on Facebook, at Flash in Deadpan, no the, Twitter, and Instagram, Flash in the Deadpan Productions.
Oh. You added Instagram, nice.
We did. We have two pictures on there right now, but we have auditions coming up, so hopefully we'll get some more pictures.
Oh, there you go. I know there are a lot of actors on campus here, so maybe they'll come down. Yeah. I will be back on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Source's Guelph with Scotty Hurd. So you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back here next week at 2 p.m. Wednesday at 2 p.m. That's where we are now. For more end credits, we will see you then.